Thank you for reminding me.
Great.
All right, everyone, welcome to the May 29th, 2019 9/11 and Other Deep State Crimes teleconference. And Craig, if you would start out with a roll call.
Sure. I will read the names that I've already written down here. Adam Ruff, Cheryl Curtis, Craig McKee, Ginger Gaynor, John O'Malley, Sherry Aspen, Nita Renfrew, Jane Milliken, Alan Rubin, Barton Bruce, Richard Krushnick, Rachel Wood, Susan Serpa, Charles Ewing Smith, Ted Muga, Jessica Coco, Marty Hopper, James Hufford, Peter Ketchum, Bill Wilt, Alfred Magaletta, Mike Carey, Steve Stadola, and Lawrence Fine. Did I miss anyone? Yeah.
Last but
did I get everybody?
Okay. Just one thing, Craig. I think Nita is actually not here. It's Sherry Jacobs is on Skype, and she's coming in under her name, so I changed it. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Great. All right. So mark that.
Okay.
All right.
All right. So we're all set with that then?
Yeah.
So now for approving the minutes of the last meeting, are there anyone who wants to suggest any changes, or are we good with the minutes? Okay. Hearing no objections to the minutes, then they're approved as written. Okay. And then moving on to the agenda. Let's see. We have first up Ted Muga and Ginger Gaynor will be speaking, and Sherry is going to introduce them. So, Sherry, if you do that.
Okay, I'd be honored to do that. This is Sherry here at San Diego 9/11 Truth, and I'm really honored to be able to introduce our two guests today who are also my friends, and that is Ted Muga. He started San Diego 9/11 Truth back in 2006. And in 2013, when I woke up to this truth, I didn't know what to do. And I found them. And they took me in. And I've been with them ever since. And that's when I met Ginger, who is Ginger. I'll do Ginger first, ladies first. Ginger is a retired flight attendant and international purser for American Airlines. She has 34 years seniority when she retired in 2005. She was qualified on the American Airlines configuration of the Boeing 757 and 767. She'll be discussing how she came to be involved in the San Diego 9/11 Truth, focusing on the Pentagon, American Flight 77, and the onboard air phones Ted Olson claimed his wife Barbara, a passenger on Flight 77, used to call him at the office in the Justice Department. She's still very much in touch with many of the flight attendants, and she is an amazing woman to listen to. I can just listen to her for hours. And then Mr. Ted Muga, he is a structural engineer. I believe it's a BSCE degree. And he's a former naval aviator, retired Navy commander, and also a retired commercial pilot for Pan American Airways. And he's 80 years young, and he has a beautiful wife, Nelise, who is my good friend, and a cat that will kill my dog if I bring it over there. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to, I guess, Ginger.
Hey, I think Ted should probably start off. I can kind of follow up on what he has to say.
Okay, that's fine.
Go for it, Ted.
Okay, here I go. First of all,
can they hear you?
Can everybody hear me real good?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. I'm assuming everybody can hear me real good. And we'll start off here. Primarily, we're talking about the Pentagon and basically the official story from the Pentagon does not have near or any evidence at all that it is valid. And so this is where I come in. There is basically no evidence that a large aircraft crashed into the Pentagon. If there were a crash, you would have over 60 tons of a metal airplane, you would have two titanium composite engines, and you would have a landing gear assembly, which is the highest grade structural steel there is, because those landing gears take a beating of their whole life. In addition, you have all of the fireproof material in an airplane, and then on top of that, all of the 64 passengers that were aboard. There were no, with the images on television and newspaper photos and books with their photos and everything, there has never been shown any evidence that any of the original items that I just mentioned were ever shown as evidence. So basically, there is no evidence that a large commercial airplane crashed into the plane. The source, of course, the official story, of course, is the same source that gave us the story of the Tonkin Gulf incident. The same source gave us the story of the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And the same source were the same people that participated in the cover-up of the USS Liberty. So basically, when you start thinking about the official story, it just doesn't hold together. In addition to Ginger, when she talks about other possible reasons why we don't believe there was a large commercial aircraft crashing into the Pentagon, there's a gentleman, a Major General Stubblebine, S-T-U-B-B-L-E-B-I-N-E. Google his name on there, and he is he was in charge of the air intelligence and security in the middle 80s. And this guy is an expert in reviewing investigations and everything, and he is adamant that there is no evidence at all that a large commercial airplane crashed into the Pentagon. There were many eyewitnesses, of course, on television as they were looking at the scene from the front of the Pentagon, and one of the easiest ones to remember, Peter Jennings, he says, there is no, as he's looking at the Pentagon, he is saying, I see no evidence at all that a plane has crashed into this building at all.
McIntyre.
And so with that brief summary that I just gave, that's about the best and easiest summary I can give. And I'll stand by for any questions if anybody has. So I'll let Ginger go in from here.
Okay. Well, as Sherry mentioned, I flew for American for 34 years. I had about 30 years seniority at the time of 9/11, and I flew 767, 777, 777. I was qualified on the 757, and I flew as a purser, which means you kind of coordinate the crew and keep track of the paperwork, and you have to kind of be on top of everything that has to do procedurally, et cetera. And so I had I was actually in Tokyo on a layover when 9/11 happened. And I have some mutual acquaintances. They're not close friends, but I had some mutual acquaintances, not close friends, who had a mutual interest in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. I have a condo up there that I rent out. And these were flight attendants, and they were on board Flight 77. Their name was Ken and Jennifer Lewis. They were quite a couple. They know it called them Kennifer. They were quite a lot of fun and very adventuresome. In any case, they had left a message for me the day before I got on my answering machine saying, hey, Ginger, it's Ken and Jennifer. We want to rent you one-bedroom condo up in Jackson Hole for my 50th birthday coming up. I believe it was in February of 2002. So we're sure you're flying. We're flying tomorrow. Give me a call when you get back. That was the message. And you could, of course, access it from wherever you were in the world. And then that night, late that night in Tokyo, the whole thing came down, the whole 9/11 thing. And so now we were stuck in Tokyo for 5 days, and we did not know who was on the crew of the various flights until 3 days later, because they were keeping it quiet until they had definitive facts and wanted it. And then they finally released it 3 days later. And I'm looking at the names, and I'm going, oh, my God, that's Ken and Jennifer, who just left a message on my machine. And, of course, they were Washington, D.C.-based, and so they were flying 77. And so that's always haunted me. And so I started looking into it, and thank God for Ted and Lalise Muga, who started the San Diegans for 9/11 Truth. I initially got into Adam mentioned the name Abby Martin's group, when I had just retired. It was about 2005. Started looking around to see if I could find out more about 9/11. It just didn't add up. And was active with her meetup group, and then that merged into Ted and Elise's wonderful group. And so regarding the Pentagon, that's why I was more interested in the Pentagon, because they were on that flight, 77. And I totally agree with every word that Ted said. There is absolutely no evidence whatsoever that 757 hit that building. My kind of point of interest here was, because I was qualified on the aircraft as a purser, I knew for a fact that the airphones had been deactivated well before 9/11, I think about 7.5 months before, in January, I believe it was, but I wasn't exactly sure when. And it got very interesting the way this evolved, sort of revisionist history. Anyone who has an airline background or military background, Ted can go over this, or have ever worked with corporate manuals. Flight attendants have a manual, pilots have a manual, and it covers every single procedure or change of equipment, oxygen bottles, whatever. And when you update it, the FAA mandates by law that you keep your manual up to date. And so you make entries when you get a revision that comes in your mailbox. And so you make sure that you put it in before you leave on your next flight, and you have to enter when you put it in, and you also have to enter on a log when you take it out in the front of the manual. And so it's fairly standard procedure. Well, what I got to thinking when Ted Olson said his wife called him from an airphone, it just didn't make sense, because the 757 had a different airphone company, I think it was GTE airphone, than the AT&T airphones on the other equipment, on the 767, 777. The 757 had GTE airphones, and they eliminated it fairly early before the other aircraft configurations, because it just wasn't used, and it was very expensive. They were in the coach. These airphones were in the center seat, in the back of the center seat on either side of the airplane, with a tether that would go as far as the window seat or the aisle seat, but not long enough to go across the aisle. So, because of course people would be walking by to go to the bathroom, walk right into somebody's, airphone cord and rip it out. So initially, I believe the allegation was that she was in the back of the aircraft and was talking on the airphone, Ted Olson said. Well, unless she was physically sitting in a row with an airphone, which they were deactivated anyway, she could not have done that. What they do when they deactivate something, they send an update out for our manual, and I remember that it had been deactivated, and they had not yet removed, on some 757s, the physical airphones from the seats, because they were waiting for a major C-check, they call it, maintenance check, when they change out seats, et cetera. At that point, they would get rid of them. So instead, what they do is they collar a circuit breaker in the cockpit, meaning they put a little round gizmo around it, and it deactivates the circuit breaker. And, of course, American Airlines deactivated their contract with GTE Airphone. So even if there were airphones on the airplane, they were not functioning. They were deactivated. And so they may have physically been there, but they weren't being used and couldn't be used. So Ted Olson changed his story, I think, to The Guardian the next day and changed it and said she was on a cell phone. But fortunately, due to the Mousawi trial, all the major cell phone carriers said they testified at the Mousawi trial, and they said no. None of them, Sprint, Verizon, whoever, they said no phone call came through to the Pentagon or to the Justice Department, to Ted Olson's office. I was speaking with Adam earlier. It was one. They said one signal for 1 second that never went through. So it couldn't be an airphone, and it couldn't be a cell phone. The thing that I found interesting that hasn't really been brought up, regarding his manuals, I know it sounds mundane, but it's significant. Once you get it, when you go through training, you get a manual, and it is yours for life. And as I mentioned, you're obligated to keep it updated at all times. And so I, at the time, had been flying for 30 years, and that was my manual, updated every time there was a new revision. And the strangest thing happened in, I believe, at what we call EPT's emergency procedural training the following year. I believe it was 2002. It might have been 2003. For the first time in all those years, at that point, 32 years of flying, we went to emergency procedural training, and oddly, the instructor said, hey, we've decided to just get everybody updated, make sure everything's just set, so bring your manuals up here and throw them in a pile. We're giving you brand-new manuals. And that just is unheard of.
What?
And I remember that, and I didn't think much of it at the time. But then later, when I started to get very interested in this whole project about, you know, Ted Olson and Barbara Olson and the whole thing, I realized there went the evidence that the airphones had been deactivated on the 757 prior to 9/11. And so we had, I knew a maintenance technician would be able to check it, and we never could get anybody to put their name on it that they had been deactivated. But David Ray Griffin finally, in one of his many wonderful books, followed through on that and found an American Airlines maintenance person who found the date that the airphones were deactivated. I believe it was January 31st, 2001, 7.5 months before 9/11. Though he did not add his name to it, he presented the evidence, and I believe David Ray Griffin has that evidence. So that was what I wanted to present to everybody. And I'm open for any questions anybody else might have. So,
okay. All right, we're going into lecture mode, and let's see. If you'd like to ask a question of either Ted or Ginger, oh, wait, hang on a second. Yes, if you'd like to answer a question of either of them, please do star 6, and that'll get you into the lineup. So anyone with a question, please push star 6.
Hello?
Yes. Hang on a second, Ginger. I'm not seeing anyone for asking a question here. Let's see.
Maybe we don't have any questions.
There you go. Maybe not.
That's what I think.
Okay, so again, if you want to ask a question, please do star 6.
I'll ask one, Cheryl.
Go ahead, Craig. Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, first of all, I guess, Ted, one of the big arguments that we've been hearing from people in the movement who assert that a 757 did hit the Pentagon, they keep talking about the damage to the building and saying since there's no other way for the damage to have been caused other than a large plane impact, then therefore a large plane impact must have happened. And I just wondered what you think is kind of the best response to that. I know you've mentioned the lack of wreckage, and I don't know if that's it or not, but that would be my first part. And the second part would be the other issue that I find we run into a lot is people putting the burden of proof on us rather than on the government. In other words, we have to prove what happened rather than the government having to prove what happened. So I just wondered if you'd want to comment on either of those two points.
Okay, this is Ted, and I'll start with the second one about the burden of proof. The government could solve all of the problems by simply showing one of the video images that one of the cameras on the Pentagon picked up. There were over 40 cameras there. There were the cameras across the street at one of the hotels and one of the service stations. They all had the perfect view at the service station. The tenant there actually said within 2 minutes after the crash, the FBI was on site taking possession of all of their cameras. So once again, for burden of proof, if in fact the government, the sources that are making up the official story, wanted us to believe that, all they would have to do is show us one of those videos off the Pentagon camera. And the first part, as to if a big plane didn't hit it, if you look at the images of the Pentagon after the crash and everything, the hole at the beginning would not be anything close to what a large commercial aircraft would have done. More than likely, they were pre-planted explosives inside the building that were going off at that time. There is a small possibility, though, that there could have been an air-to-ground missile that had been put into the building by the one observed military airplane that was on site in the area. And that one hole, it's very possible, although I have never seen any evidence of the missile tubing or the engine that a missile would have. They did show one picture of people carrying out a large container that was completely covered up and unidentified and being carried by about 10 or 12 people, which could very well have been the engine pod of an air-to-ground missile that was inside. But other than that undescribable package that was being carried out, there's no evidence at all that a large commercial airplane. And one other item that I mentioned earlier, in addition to the 60-ton airplane and all of the fireproof, the thousands of gallons of jet fuel that would have been inside the building. And when they showed pictures inside the building, they were pictures that would imply that there were explosives, not a large jet engine fire. And that's my two answers to your question.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And then are you finished, Craig?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Ted, another question for you. The ground force or the G-force or something with planes that can't fly that close to
the ground.
The
ground effect. I was just going to mention that. It's Ginger. Very interesting fact.
Yeah, so would that be impossible to fly a plane that close to the ground, that speed?
Well, going to aerodynamics, once again, a plane at the official speed that the official story said was 530 miles an hour could not fly that close to the ground at that speed. That's just aerodynamics, just basic aerodynamics. That would be as simple as a mathematical question. How much is 2 and 2? It's got to be 4, and you can't deviate from that. So from a
standpoint,
basic aerodynamics, a large commercial airplane with those type of wings, with the size of the wings, could not fly. Now, jet fighters in the military, jet fighters, they have the swept wings and much smaller wings, and they're designed to get very, very close to the ground at times. But that's not how they design large commercial airplanes.
And, Ted, didn't you once say that aerodynamically it's actually double your wingspan at that speed? In other words, the lowest you can get to the closest to the ground is twice your wingspan, and that would have put the airplane over the top of the Pentagon, given the ground effect.
That's aerodynamics, and when you read the books, the scientific books in aerodynamics, that's what they will tell you, that is as close to the ground that a plane can get. The only time you experience aerodynamic situation is when you come in for a landing. Every now and then, because you're coming in real slow, and you start to, and occasionally, if you don't make your landing just exactly right, the plane will start to float on you, and that's because you didn't have enough downward momentum to get past that one deterrent of the air below you. But that's the only time you would experience, and that is at the lowest airspeed possible for the airplane. But once again, the scientific books do, in fact, say that it's twice the wingspan that a plane can get to the ground at those high speeds.
Oh, good to know. Thank you. And then, Barbara, I have a question for you also, and you may not be able to answer this, but do you have any thoughts on where Barbara Olson is or why they would have, you know, said she was on that plane? And
was that for me, Ginger?
Yes, for Ginger. I'm sorry, Ginger, yeah.
I have no clue. I've always been rather intrigued to find out what the stature and physique of his new wife is, if it's similar to what Barbara's was.
Yeah.
But I have no idea.
Okay. Just thought I'd ask. I didn't think you'd have an answer for that. Now, I'm just wondering if the lecture mode is working, so I'm going to unmute everybody.
Yes. Yeah, Cheryl. I just.
Oh, thank you.
The Boston.
I couldn't put my thing in.
It wasn't working? Okay. Does anyone would anyone like to ask a question? We'll just have to.
I would like to ask a question.
And who's that?
Is Lorenzo.
Okay, Lorenzo, go ahead.
Oh, actually, it's a correction. It I believe that it's Jamie McIntyre that was the journalist who reported, was one
That's
of the was the journalist who we use mostly for corroborating the no wreckage at the Pentagon.
Jamie McIntyre, you're correct.
And the other one would be Lieutenant Richard Medeiros, Robert or Richard Medeiros, who was Arlington, Virginia police officer.
Okay. Anyone else would like to ask a question?
Yes, Chuck, this is Adam. I would like to.
Adam, go ahead.
Hi, Ted and Ginger. Can you speak just briefly on the major no-no that was seen after the Flight 77 overflew the Pentagon? There were men seen walking around the crime scene at the Pentagon picking up debris
yes.
before any investigation had taken place. Now, isn't that a crime in and of itself?
Well, I'm no attorney, but obviously it's on the assumption that the NTSB would have been investigating, which, of course, they weren't because it was considered a crime, so the FBI, I think, took over. But nonetheless, that just stands to reason that exactly what you said, that that would never be done. My thought, I've done some research on this, and sadly we had about, I don't know how many years, maybe 3 or 4 years prior to that, American had lost a 757 in Cali, Colombia. It came down and scraped the top of a hill and crashed. And it wouldn't surprise me that some of the little chunks that may have been scattered about the lawn may have been pieces from the Cali crash. I don't know.
Oh.
Well, can I also add one more comment? This is just from my own personal research.
Hello?
We can hear you, Sherry. Yeah.
Thank you. You cut for a long time. Thank you. I have a question.
Okay, Sherry, if you can just hang on a minute and let Adam finish his. Okay.
I am. I just wanted to make sure you can hear me. Thanks.
Yeah, we can.
Okay.
Adam?
So my question is, I've kind of done sort of a basic guesswork on how much of the fuselage is covered with the American Airlines paint scheme, where it actually spells out American.
Right.
And I've noticed that almost all of the visible pieces of wreckage come from that portion of the fuselage which has letters on it, which I find very convenient since that portion of the fuselage is only maybe 5% of the total fuselage area. So for all these pieces to have the American logo paint on there, it seems very suspicious to me, and that was my comment.
It does seem awfully odd that it was very convenient to give the impression, yes.
Okay.
I agree with you.
Anybody else have a question?
Yes.
Chuck Smith.
I'm sorry, could you all say that again?
James Chuck Smith.
James, okay. James, go ahead.
If 757 didn't hit the Pentagon, what do we know about what happened to the flight and to other passengers?
We don't.
Actually,
well, that's what got my interest. That's why I became interested. I wanted to know what happened to Ken and Jennifer. I still do.
Yeah, well, actually, there's so much information that we don't know. Keep in mind, all of the evidence that we have comes from government sources, and the government sources are not there to provide us with the information that we really need on a lot of these events. They are there primarily, well, actually, we've been actually, as the masses of people, we have been conditioned to be spoon-fed all of our information via television and newspapers and everything. And so they have the upper hand in getting out the information. Mm-hmm. So really, a lot of the information that's really interesting, like what happened to the real airplanes, what happened to the passengers, we just flat do not know. It's all speculation.
I thought that the air traffic control lost Flight 77 somewhere around Cleveland or something like that. This is the flight that flew way east and then turned around and came back. I mean, flew way west, then turned around and came back east toward the Pentagon. And so if indeed the flight was lost somewhere around Cleveland, then the speculation was that it landed at that decommissioned Air Force base and that any passengers would have been disposed of there at the airport, decommissioned Air Force base.
Okay.
Well, that's a little bit from the Rebecca Roth book, you know, whether that is valid or not. I've heard it was Cleveland Hopkins that some planes landed, but then they couldn't verify it. Maybe the other side of the field was an Air Force base at the commercial airport.
Yeah, that was from the video, Loose Change, where they talked about that one. Mm-hmm. And it's all these are all possibilities. I mean, there's evidence that a plane, that they landed there, but we still don't know what happened to all of the passengers.
Exactly. May I make a comment back to Adam about what he was just talking about? I wanted to pursue that for a second.
Sure.
I find that one of the pieces that was allegedly on the Pentagon lawn, one of the chunks, is a clear picture of an American Airlines serial number sticker to a piece of wreckage. And I have it on my desktop. It's always intrigued me. And clearly, where it says S/AA and then below it S/N, it shows the number 944 in relatively new marker, black marker pen. But the aircraft number that actually crashed at the Pentagon was N644. So that might, you might want to elaborate on that a little bit. I mean, pursue that, because I find it very interesting that somebody may have hastily and inadvertently written on one of these pieces of wreckage they had and corrected whatever was originally on that, whatever crashed in Cali, Colombia. And it looks like they changed it out and put, they were supposed to put 644 and they put 944, because I got a picture of it. I find that very interesting. So I just wanted to add that to my answer to Adam.
Yeah. Okay, anyone else? Sherry, you had a question, you said, right?
Yeah, I do. Ted, do you think that the planes were intercepted as a documentary of the same name by Pilots for 9/11 Truth? And you told me, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you thought that Pilots for 9/11 Truth did such great research and got so close to the actual truth of what happened in the air that that organization was infiltrated. And I was wondering, why do you think that Chandler, Costa, and Duane are doing what they're doing? So those questions, if you could say a few words.
Yeah, two different questions there, but to bring them together and everything. Once again, it's to muddy the water and to make the opposition, which is what we are, as ineffective as possible, and to just to tie us down, really. Once again, when the opposition controls corporate media completely, and so they have a huge advantage over the public, which is trying to get the truth out. And so a lot of these possibilities that we're talking about are just what they are, possibilities. We just don't have access to the necessary evidence to really say what has happened to the aircraft or the passengers.
Okay.
And what about Pilots for 9/11 Truth? Can you tell us what happened to that? Because a lot of their links are completely dead on their site, and it's just not really functioning.
Yeah. Well, once again, it's been many, many years and everything, and people just get tired of working on this particular issue and everything. I know, and then the organization, the leadership starts to split up, and whether L.A., San Francisco, or even maybe even Washington, D.C., and definitely in Denver, these 9/11 groups that are very, very effective have to be infiltrated and turned around as best that they can. And once again, our San Diego group down here is essentially unimpenetrable. They can't do much with what we're doing down here. But these other areas, we have talked to their leaders, and it has always been just a split up of the leaders or some obvious infiltrations into the groups.
Great, thank you.
Okay. I have a question. This is Nalise.
Okay.
And when roll was called, Marty Hopper, who I admire so much, I've seen some films that have come from the Denver 9/11 group, and Marty and Fran Schur have just, and other members there have just put out an excellent film called, I think it's a Demolition of Truth. And Marty, I just wanted to ask you, because we kept getting invitations to come to the conference in Denver.
Okay, so,
Nalise?
Yes. I'm sorry, but right now, if you want to ask a question of the two speakers, that's what this time is for. If you want to talk to her later at the end of the call, you could do that.
Thank you. Sorry.
Okay, thanks. Yep. Anyone else have a question for the
James
speaker?
James Huffman.
Go ahead, James.
I wanted to ask Ginger, or anyone actually, with this information about the cell phones and the plane phones being actually either inoperable or impossible to get a message through to the ground. Do you know of any instances where that is presented in public to any defenders of the official story, and what their response has been to that information?
Well, I was looking this morning, just glancing around to see what's online, because as Ted says, they continually print up new misinformation. And there was a 9/11 myths. So there's a website about 9/11 myths, and they skirted over the whole thing, saying that American Airlines. This was a couple. A researcher had called American Airlines Public Relations, and I think a representative named Kinder, K-I-N-D-E-R, and they asked if there are airphones on the 757, and the person said no. But, of course, he was answering the question for the current day, and he didn't get into any detail about what was going on 9/11. But the customer service rep said, no, there are no airphones on the 757. This was probably 2004. So it was sort of a moot point, obviously. They're very vague answers on that 9/11 myths, I think was the name of it. I'll see if I can Google it.
Yeah.
But no. The only other thing is he changed his story and sold. I believe he told the Guardian that she'd switched to her cell phone. That was physically impossible because of the speed and the altitude at the point at which somebody's nailed down the time that she would have been calling him, and way, way too high and too fast. A cell phone couldn't catch up between the towers for her to come through. And, of course, then the proof is in the Moussaoui trial.
Well, that seems to me like a really important point to emphasize, because so much of the official story rests on that particular segment.
It sure does, and I totally agree with you. It's just interesting too that I know it sounded rather mundane, but it was shocking to me when they took all of our manuals that at that point would have had the date and time that the 75 phones had been deactivated, and just quietly collected them all and gave us a new manual. Inevitably, the new manual wouldn't have shown that.
Well, I've always wondered if any of the high up defenders of the official story really believe it at all.
I have no idea what
doubt
those people
that they do.
Ask Dick Cheney. God knows.
Yeah, I'm sure he doesn't believe it.
Well, I mean, and the whole thing about box cutters, and that's where we got, you're right, it's significant, because that's where we got this alleged information about box cutters and herding people to the back. Everyone, I only met Chick Burlingame once or twice, and he was quite the macho captain, a very nice guy, but as everyone said, there is no way that Chick Burlingame was going to give up his aircraft to people probably a foot shorter than he was and be herded to the back of an airplane. He just wouldn't do it. He wouldn't have put up with that.
Well, isn't that really the only so-called evidence that there were hijackers, actually?
Precisely. And the whole concept of box cutters came from that phone call.
Exactly.
I crazy. Said again, to answer a question, all of these speculations and questions could all be easily answered very simply by the government. All they would have to do is show a couple of the videos from the Pentagon cameras, and that would answer all of our questions.
And the fact that they don't tell
them something. This is Chuck Smith.
Go ahead, Chuck.
I've been of the mind that the planes were remote controlled and that there were transponders placed in the locations that they hit. That's the only reason they could hit so precisely. And that they were that. So my question is that, do you think if they were remote controlled, is there any way possible that you say a large commercial plane? But what if it was just a big plane that had some paint, some AA paint on it or something, but it wasn't as big as a large commercial plane, but big enough? Do you think something like that could be that precisely, fly that fast and hit that target precisely without messing the lawn?
Hey, but this is Ted, and that would be just speculation. Once again, whether it's a big plane or a small plane, there has got to be some kind of physical evidence on the ground, or you can't say that a plane hit the ground.
Okay.
Well, yeah.
Cheryl, I'd like to ask a second question, but I don't want to jump in if there's somebody that hasn't asked a first one, but I would like to ask another one if I can.
Is there anyone else who would like to ask a first question?
John O'Malley.
Okay, John. Craig, we'll get to you last then, all right?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, John?
I talked to a guy who actually knew the Olsons, and I tried to tell him about Building 7 and all that stuff, and he just wouldn't go there. And I don't know if he was just completely clueless or was a very good actor, but I think there's a lot of people who can be very close to a false flag and not see what is right in front of them because they don't want to see it. Over.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's for sure.
Yeah. Any other questions?
I have one more after everybody else has a question.
Okay, great. Then, Craig, if you want to go.
Me too. This is Adam Ruff.
Adam, okay. So Craig, Sherry, and then Adam, and then we'll close it there, all right?
Great, yeah. This is for either Ted or Ginger. Actually, two quick comments. One is we've heard from some in the movement who are supporting an impact that the plane never was lost to radar the whole time, the whole flight, meaning that it would be Flight 77 that they're alleging hit the Pentagon. They're saying that as the plane passed from one radar station to another, that it was never gone from contact. My understanding was that there was a period of time when it was lost entirely to radar, and that would have made a given an opportunity for, a plane switch of some kind to have taken place. So that's number one. The second one is a little one, has to do with the whole idea of the plane flying parallel to the ground across the lawn, as is alleged. I guess, Mike, what I'm wondering is it possible for a plane just, a few hundred feet away to hit these light poles about 20 feet up in the air, and then descend fast enough to be parallel and level with the ground within a split second and then continue level into the building. Those are the two things I would raise.
Okay, well, with the second one and the plane hitting the light poles out there, if that had actually happened, the plane would have never made it to the Pentagon. Those wings are nothing but fuel, and you would have had an unbelievable explosion at that point there. And so that evidence was fabricated somehow or another. I'm not sure just how, but there's no way that a plane could have hit those light poles with a full wing of fuel and gone much further. It would just been a big ball of fire at that point. Ginger, you can have the next one.
What next question?
The other being the radar question that I asked.
I'm a little vague on that one.
Let me add to that one, Ginger. On the radar image, don't forget, during the day, there were over, 40 simulated war games going on at the same time, and simulated radar images on everybody's radar scope. So we do not know what evidence was actually the evidence of a plane on the scope or whether it was a simulated image on the scope. They were able to put this thing together extremely well so that they could pretty much question anything that ever happened. And so, once again, they're very, very confident that even though everything doesn't go perfect and there's a lot of questions, they were able to get away with it, and they so far have accomplished their mission.
Thank you.
I'd like to add a couple of things to that. I have one of my flight attendant friends here in San Diego has a sister whom I met at a big birthday party we were having for my friend. And she was an air traffic controller at Dulles that day. And I met her probably in 2004, maybe 3. But anyway, she told me that several things about being in the tower, being evacuated, coming back in. Anyway, years later, as I pursued this, maybe 5-6 years later, I asked my friend if I could talk to her sister, the woman who was the air traffic controller. And I didn't talk to her, but I emailed her, and she responded, and she said, I can't discuss anything, and I am on an inactive list on a psychological leave.
Wow.
Yep. Oh, that's interesting. Okay, and then Sherry, you had a question?
Yes, I would like to know from each of you, just very quickly, what do you think hit the Twin Towers? What do you think hit the Twin Towers? Just that's what I would like to know.
Ginger speaking here, I would suspect that one of the remote-controlled aircraft, just as I believe Adam was saying, probably created by Dov Zakheim, who was the controller of the Pentagon. That was his day job, converting commercial to, I think, remote-controlled aircraft. That's what I'm thinking. Probably because, as you mentioned, every pilot I know said they tried at that speed and altitude, which would rip the wings off pretty much as I understand it, they tried to hit the towers and could not do it in the simulator.
This is Lorenzo. I'd like to ask another question.
Yeah, Lorenzo, can you just hang on where Adam is next, and then you can go?
Sure.
Okay. Adam?
Hi. Well, this is a little factoid I was looking into about 8 or 9 years ago regarding the Pentagon. I was told by someone that just the jet fuel alone that would have been left at the Pentagon would have required a toxic cleanup crew and EPA involvement if a plane had actually crashed there. And I don't believe there was any sort of toxic cleanup done at the Pentagon after.
Yeah, if you look at
go ahead.
This is Ted. If you look at some of the internet website where they have the interior photos and everything, You're absolutely right. There is no evidence of a fuel fire at all. Everything is sort of smashed and you know, blown to pieces, but nothing that you would that would appear to be a large jet fuel fire at all. So what you're asking is exactly correct.
And one of the windows right exactly near where it went in wasn't even broken. Let me break.
An April
gown. Okay. I mean, that's pretty hard. There was a desk that was not burned. There was a book on a desk that was not burned. And the adjacent window right near where the wing would have been going in was not even broken. Take a close look at those photos.
Okay. And Lorenzo, your question?
Well, first of all, totally in agreement about what you guys are talking about, no plane, no wreckage at the Pentagon. This was, since it was entered into, regarding the aircraft that struck the towers, a lot of people have alluded that it was a remote control, and that kind of gives to somebody to be controlling it, namely a pilot. In my opinion, I believe a number of other people believe that it was an autonomous onboard system and that there was most likely a target on the buildings that the aircraft struck, because those aircraft were essentially become guided missiles. They struck probably within 5 feet of the vertical center of that building, just from the pictures that I've seen. That's an extremely accurate strike.
I agree.
I do too.
That was, I guess I didn't have a question.
Okay.
But it's
all right. So, did someone say something?
I just think it is fascinating that they could strike that centrally, and it had to have been with sensors put in the buildings. I understand the Israeli art students that were working on the Pentagon, they'd had access to the Pentagon for several months, as I understand it, may have planted sensors.
Are you still talking about the Twin Towers?
Yes. Okay.
I
still
agree,
talking about the Twin Towers.
That is a theory that I fully support.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
me too.
Great. So, well, Ted and Ginger, thanks so much for presenting. It's fascinating. Your knowledge is really helpful to draw an understanding of what happened there and what didn't. So thank you very much. Again, nice presentations.
Thank you.
Okay. And then...
hi, this is David Rold. I'd just like to say I got on the call around 8:25.
Okay. Thank you, David.
Great.
Awesome. Cheryl, this is Nita. I'm on the call now, too.
Oh, okay. Great. Thank you. Okay.
Great.
This is Kat McGuire. I'm on the call.
Okay. Thank you, everybody.
All right.
Anybody else that's joined late? Oh, okay. Great. So next on the agenda is Craig McKee. He's going to be presenting on Lloyd England and the Pentagon issues again. And if you all can go to the agenda that was sent out, if you have that handy, there's a link there to a video or that he's a PowerPoint that he's created. So... if you can all take a moment and do that, that would be helpful. And Craig, go ahead. Craig doesn't need really any introduction, so Craig, take it away.
Okay, thank you.
Who is your
Craig? Thank you. Okay, so, the link is in that text above the list of agenda items. If anybody doesn't have that handy, but they would still like to follow along with the PowerPoint, and I really hope you do this because, first of all, I took a lot of time to make it, so it would be great if you'd follow along with it. And also it's got photos and things that are, you know, quite pertinent to what I'll be talking about. So if you don't have it handy in your email, you can find it by going to truthandshadows.com/about. And that brings you to the page with all the archives of the teleconference, and it's the very top item in the archives. So, Mark Lloyd England, so you can find it easily there. So, so Lloyd England, my presentation is called Lloyd England, A Key to How the Truth Movement is Being Deceived About the Pentagon. In this presentation, I will review England's claim that a large pole came crashing through the windshield of his cab, and I'm going to do that reasonably briefly because I did do a presentation on this back in 2017 where I focused exclusively on... we're getting a lot of noise, a lot of background noise. Is there any way people could mute themselves?
okay.
Yeah, we're getting a lot of noise there from somebody. So anyway, I did this presentation in 2017 where I focused on all the impossibilities and improbabilities in the England story. This presentation will kind of review a few of those, but also it'll go more into kind of what's been happening in the movement on this issue more recently, because there are some very troubling things happening, honestly. So anyway, in the third slide, you see a picture of Lloyd England standing in front of his cab. This was taken by CIT when they went to see the cab in 2008. He actually had kept the cab under a tarp for all those years, and they went and were actually got a chance to take some photographs that were critical, really, in terms of exposing some of the problems with the evidence. So first, a brief summary of what the account is, what Lloyd says. Basically, he was driving south on Route 27 when he saw the plane flying over the highway. This is, again, Lloyd's account. He didn't see it hit any poles, but he did have a pole come crashing through his windshield, he claims, embedding itself in the back seat. He wrestled with the car, swerved around, and brought it to a stop with the pole sticking out of the windshield, and he flagged down another driver who helped him pull the pole out of the car. The weight caused him to fall to the ground with the pole on top of him. The stranger did not help him and didn't speak to him, but just drove off with Lloyd sitting there underneath the pole. Just one of many, many improbabilities. The passenger seat was bent back, and you'll see a photo of that shortly, but there was no tears in the upholstery. Just a small hole in the bottom of the back seat behind the passenger seat. There was no damage to the hood at all, and the passenger, the dashboard was damaged. Now, England's story, if true, would support the official flight path of the plane seen flying towards the Pentagon, as well as its minimum wingspan. It would also support the notion that the plane knocked over five poles, as the official story contends. But England's story is so full of inconsistencies, impossibilities, and suspicious elements that it is hard not to see it as a fabrication. Now, on slide 8, I have some problems with the story, and these particular ones deal with the physical evidence. The damage to the windshield, the dashboard, the passenger seat, and the back seat simply does not line up. There's no way that a pole could have hit the top of the front passenger seat, bent it, and then taken a sudden turn downward and made a very tiny hole near the bottom of the back seat. There's no scratch on the hood, which you'll see shortly why that's a problem. The hole in the back seat is much, much too small. And I was going to say number 4 there. England said many times to CIT on camera that he was not on the bridge going over Columbia Pike, but he admitted off camera that the man who took the photos of his cab was on the bridge. So he got caught there. And also just the impossibility of the two men lifting the pole out of the car to start with. Now, according to the official story, the plane's right wing knocked pole number 1 to the left of the fuselage, where it is supposed to have hit Lloyd's cab. And then you see on the next photograph, you see a picture with a red line going through showing the official flight path and the five light poles. And then the blue line is the approximate path recounted by some of the north of Sitco witnesses. Now we're on slide 11. No witness reported seeing anything hit Lloyd's cab. No one says they saw the cab swerving or traveling with the pole sticking out of the windshield, and no one says they saw someone pulling a pole out of the car. Now in the next one, we see a photograph that shows the pole number 1 and what the end of it looked like, and you can see how when you see the other photo of the back seat in a moment, you'll see why it's impossible that that made that damage. And in fact, here it is, the next one, slide 13. This is the hole that the pole is supposed to have made. And you can see how ridiculous that is. The foam underneath the upholstery is not even visibly damaged. Damage apparently caused to the passenger seat by the pole is visible in this picture, which was taken by England's wife, Shirley, the day after 9/11. He claims that the pole went through the dashboard before hitting the seat and then stopping in the back seat. Now, here's a shot taken by CIT in 2008. You can see the car is deteriorated in condition quite a bit, but you can still see the passenger seat, and you can see how impossible it would be for a pole to hit that seat and then go down and make that hole. Now, with next one, we have one that shows the absence of damage to the hood. I'm not sure why I'm hearing an echo of my own voice. I'm going to try to ignore that as best I can. I mean, you can see the damage to the dashboard. Sorry?
Well, no, yeah.
Okay. So you can see the damage to the dashboard in that photograph, and you can see the hood, how much higher the hood is than that damaged dashboard. And the pole is supposed to have made the damage to the dashboard without touching the hood. Physically impossible. Now, the next one, this is the pole that England explicitly claims hit his cab. And you can see how large that is. On the next slide, you can see a scratch that appears to have been made by the pole being dragged on the road, dragged into position. Now, the citizen investigation team interviewed England twice, in 2006 for the video The First Known Accomplice, and in 2008 for Lloyd England and His Taxi Cab, The Eye of the Storm. In both interviews, England made it clear that he was alleging that his car had been hit by the long end of the first pole hit. This is bad news for the official story and for those who want to convince us that most of that story is true. Now, England tells us over and over that the long piece of the pole... am I the only one hearing the echo? I'm just curious.
I can hear it, but it's mild. It's not very loud.
Yeah, it's super, super annoying, but I don't know how to
dig
what to do about it. I'll just plow through. So he tells us over and over that the long piece of the pole, which he told both CIT and Jeff Hill was between 30 and 40 feet long, is what hit his car after being knocked off its base by the plane he claims to have seen crossing over the highway. This can only be the first pole that is alleged to have been hit by Flight 77. And you can see on slide 21, you can see the five different poles and where they all ended up, or perhaps were there all along, more likely. Now, we don't have to guess which pole he meant, because England points to it right on camera. And in the next slide, you can see that. This is from the video Eye of the Storm. It's right at the 30-minute mark. You can go and watch this yourself. He's discussing with Craig Ranke of CIT in this part of the video where he was on the highway. And he's saying, no, I wasn't there. I wasn't on the bridge. I was much farther away. But he does point to that pole, and he says, this shows the pole here. So he has no quarrel with that being the right pole. He's just challenging the idea of where he was. Then the following one, where you can see this is the photo that you saw in the previous one. This is what Lloyd was pointing at. And you'll notice that the pole, there's a small piece on the left side, which will come into the discussion in a moment, which Lloyd did not point at. Now, why does this all matter? It matters if one wants to understand how David Chandler, Wayne Costey, and the rest of the Pentagon Impact Group have misrepresented the evidence as it relates to the Lloyd England story. For years, this group stated, as if it's an established fact, that England was saying it was the long end of the pole, and they had no problem asserting that this fit with the physical evidence. As recently as their 2016 paper rebutting the work of Barbara Honegger, this was their position. And you can see there the names of the authors of that paper, including David Chandler. In the following slide, 27, we see a screenshot from the actual paper where they say that it's the large end of pole one that hit the cab. This point has been made in a number of the papers that the group has done. If the cab damage matched the long pole just 3 years ago, why not now? But then came Costey, who decided that the group needed a way around the inconvenient evidence. So he invented new evidence. He began claiming it was probably an 11.5-foot section of pole 2 that did the damage, not the much larger mast of pole 1. Now he simply states it as a fact that it was this shorter section of pole 2. This is the same as when he and Chandler stated as fact that a shadow of a 757 was captured on the Sitco video and that the right engine of the plane carved a notch in the top of a tree with the stripped foliage causing the smoke trail seen in the government's Pentagon video. They surmise and call it fact. The rest of the pro-impact group soon dropped their previous contention of more than a dozen years and began saying Costi has proven it was the shorter section. John Wyndham has said that. But this claim is based on nothing more than what they need to make England's story appear to make sense and appear to fit the evidence. And for them, it must do that. But what about England's clear statements about which pole it was? And that's where things get really crazy. Costi and Chandler claim that England never unambiguously said it was the long end of pole 1, even though, as you can see in the photo, I repeated the same photo, he points right at the pole. But worse than that, Chandler claims England was trying to tell CIT that it wasn't the long end of the pole, but they bullied him and put words in his mouth to get the answer they wanted. This is a fabrication. Costi and Chandler grossly, and I believe deliberately, misrepresent what England was saying, which was focused on where his cab was. He claims it was hundreds of feet farther north than all the photos show, and not which pole hit it. The next slide, in the interview that I referred to, it was done by a supporter of that group called J.M. Talbu. It was a podcast. And in the interview, he talks about CIT speaking to England like fast-talking telemarketers engaged in a marketing campaign, which is another absurd distortion. In the CIT video that I mentioned earlier, Ranke shows England the long pole and asks him if this is the pole that hit his cab. He says, yeah. Ranke asks again because he is trying to show England that his car is at the bridge. The second time, England does not respond as he grapples with the implications of his car being where he said it wasn't. Chandler and Costi say this means England is refusing to confirm it was pole one, but it is obvious to anyone watching that this was not the case. In a podcast interview, the one I mentioned a moment ago, Chandler says, and as Wayne Costi has pointed out, there is nowhere in any of CIT's videos that Lloyd England unambiguously identifies that long 25-foot piece as the piece that he's not claiming that's the piece that hit his car. But he does, repeatedly. Not only does England say over and over that it was the long end of the pole, the part attached to the ground that he pulled from his cab, he also specifies that the thinner, lighter top was inside the cab, while the heavier base was sticking out. This would make no sense if he meant the short piece, which did not have a heavier end. And here's a couple of little excerpts from comments that England made in the videos. And I encourage people to go and watch the videos yourselves because, this is just an excerpt, and I don't want anyone feeling that it is taken out of context in any way. So by all means, watch the videos. Russell Pickering, who was accompanied to CIT, says, "So it's the long piece." England said, "Yes, the long piece. See, it's the long piece. See the end on it." I can't imagine how much clearer he could be than that. And he says in 2008 to Craig Ranke that it was between 30 and 40 feet long. And he mentions to Jeff Hill in a separate interview 2 years later that the pole was 40 feet long. And then you have another confirmation of that there, Aldo Marquis saying that to him. So obviously England's claim is impossible. But Costi and Chandler take most of it as truth, the part that actually supports the official story. And they reject the part that exposes the fabrication. They use England's irreconcilable claims not to cast doubt on his story, but to fix it to suit their desired conclusion. England makes the impossible assertion that he and the stranger pulled the pole out from in front of the hood, So they say it must have been the shorter piece. And there's an image of England and Russell Pickering, and Pickering's asking them how they pulled the pole out. Now, Chandler says in the Denver presentation about 3 weeks ago, he says, I don't think he did identify this, meaning long end of the pole hitting, and it doesn't appear that he did in the videos. However, even if he did, he's just wrong. He's in error, because we know he could not have been hit by any part of the first light pole. But this is a gross failure in logic. Chandler is asserting that if England's claims don't add up, this can only be because of an honest error on his part. And I have a photo there of a drawing that England did. And people on the pro-impact side of the conversation, you actually use this drawing as proof that it was the shorter end of the pole, because the pole that he's drawn doesn't look long enough to be the long end. It's an absurdly primitive drawing to use for that purpose. And you can just as easily say that the pole sticks out beyond the end of the car, so you can make the opposite claim. So Chandler and Cossey ignore the possibility that England could have been fabricating any part of his story. They simply think things must be exactly as they appear to be. Is this actually a problem of logic, or are they being deceptive? All they care about is making sure that the evidence supports or appears to support their 757 impact theory. Now, from the PowerPoint series by Chandler and Costi, we actually see this. In the rear seat, there are some holes consistent with the lower support arm being the impinging projectile. Now, there's the hole again. You've seen it before. This is what he's referring to when he says some holes. And need I say more? It's an absurd claim. And to say that it's consistent with anything is absurd. Now, is this the scientific method that Chandler talks so much about? And here we have, I want to say, give an example of Wayne Costi on his website, Dump the Shadows, which is his mocking website of me. He quotes Craig Ranke from Eye of the Storm. Here's the full quote. Previously, researchers had thought of different possible scenarios to explain this, one of them being that, well, perhaps the pole itself isn't what speared the windshield, etc. So what does Costi do? He takes the first part of the sentence off and starts with a capital W, so that now it says, well, perhaps the pole itself isn't what speared the windshield, as if that's what Ranke is saying. Could that be an accident? I can't imagine how. Now, Lloyd England's story, based on all the evidence, wasn't a mistake. It was a false statement. The damage to his taxi had to have been staged. But instead of using England's statements to challenge the 9/11 official story, Chandler and Costi twist, distort, and outright misrepresent them, along with the physical evidence, in their single-minded determination to support the official claim of a 757 impact. Their analysis is not only dead wrong, it is fraudulent. Now, I have listed 30 questions here that I included with one of my articles. I'm not going to go through them all. I invite people to sort of have a look. These are things that are questions that are unanswered, or things that just don't make sense in the story. So I'll just leave those to people to look at as they wish, and I'll hand it over for questions. And I'm sorry for the audio issues, which are really annoying to me and probably to everybody, but... What are you going to do?
It wasn't really okay. And I think our lecture mode isn't working, so I'm just going to ask people to just, if you'd like to ask a question, if you could just tell me, and then we'll go in order by...
I can't hear you with your glasses in front of your mouth.
Is there anyone who would like to ask a question of Craig? Or a comment?
I would.
That's Sherry? Yeah, go ahead, Sherry.
Yeah. Thank you. Do you know how that whole thing went in May 4th? I mean, we never got to hear back from Barbara. How was that conference thing, and who showed up, and is there – I just wondered, kind of like a little report about it. I never really got to hear.
So, again, Sherry, if you could hold that for later in the call, and we just want people to respond
okay.
to Craig's presentation at the moment. Thank you.
Okay, I just thought he might know better than anybody. Thank you.
I can just make a quick comment, Cheryl, real quick.
Okay. I don't know
how it went because there are some videos that have been released, so you can watch some of the presentations. I think they're releasing them kind of one at a time. But beyond that, I don't know.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Yeah, this is Adam. I have a question.
Okay, go ahead.
Craig, just because you and I have worked together on a lot of the Pentagon issue, can you just give kind of an estimate of what this has sort of cost you personally in terms of your time and your effort to combat these disinformation campaigns for so many years now? I know that I am extremely tired of doing it, and I just want to know what it's sort of taken a toll on you, how it's taken a toll on you, if you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, sure. I completely relate to you being tired of it. I'm certainly tired of it. And what makes me even more tired of it is that it seems to be accelerating. You know, it seems to be getting worse. We have a group of people that are supposedly within the truth movement who now seem to make this their complete 100% activity. It's awfully frustrating because I really honestly, and it's a good question actually, I actually would rather not be talking about the Pentagon. I would rather be talking to people outside the movement and raising awareness. I would rather be spend my time doing what I think truthers should be doing, which is challenging the official story, challenging the lies in the story. That's what we're supposed to be doing. But because of this group, we can either let them kind of take the issue and basically hand it over to them, or we can fight it. And if we're kind of almost damned if we do and damned if we don't. You know, if we fight it, then we're, first of all, we're accused of being divisive, and we're forced to focus on kind of an internal movement battle. And if we ignore it, well, then they just keep chipping away and chipping away. And, you know, showing us, we now have Wayne Costey saying that the American Society of Civil Engineers, the very group that was, you know, part of the cover-up with respect to the World Trade Center, we have Wayne Costey saying they've proved their case at the Pentagon that a large plane hit. And I heard the same thing from Dwayne Dietz. So, yeah, I guess you got me on a rant now. So I find it very frustrating, and it's taken, I'm sure, thousands of hours of my time, and I know yours and other people. And it seems like sometimes people that are pushing this stuff just kind of count on people getting fed up and burnt out. And, you know, I hope that doesn't happen. But anyway, so thanks for the question.
Okay, next.
This is Lorenzo. I have a question.
Okay, go ahead, Lorenzo.
Relating to this problem that we have with people not being on the same page with the story about no plane crashing at the Pentagon, I think that partly what's going on for me is that this is incensed me a bit to do deeper research into the subject, and it may be good in the end. I mean, coming to a head right now, I had the opportunity to be with Wayne a few weeks ago in Boston, in Watertown, and he knows that he's one of the most unpopular people in the quotes movement, and that nobody is offering their perspective any support, very, very little support. So, if anything, this is just keeping the conversation alive. I don't get the whole thing about motive, and I can't. I personally can't go there. I can only deal with the science of this stuff.
Well, yeah, just on the question of motive, I mean, I guess nobody can read minds, so nobody can really talk about motive. But, you know, if somebody makes a statement that is obviously false, and when it's pointed out to them that it's false, they continue to make it, what is one to say about that?
It's false.
You know, if somebody says that Lloyd England's cab, if somebody says Lloyd England does not say it was the long end of the pole that hit his cab, how can I interpret that any other way than they are being deliberately deceptive?
That they are just totally ignorant of the way things work.
Well, I don't agree with that because
I don't agree
that it's a question of being ignorant because Mr. Costi is, you know, very fond of reminding everybody how meticulously he goes through every frame of video and every piece of information, and David Chandler the same way. They're misrepresenting what Lloyd England said. I mean, as directly as you wouldn't expect anything more wrong if it came straight from the government or from Popular Mechanics. So I can't see the ignorance. I can just see deception.
But why? And that would be the question.
I don't know. I don't know. I have my suspicions, but I'm not going to.
Okay, that's enough. Onward.
Okay.
Good place to...
Thank you, Craig.
Thank you. Boeing?
Goodbye.
Okay, who would like to ask a question now? Okay, I thought I heard somebody. Okay. So last call for questions for Craig? Okay, hearing none, I guess that's...
Yeah, Adam, I'll go into another question with Craig, if you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
I've been doing research on the Pentagon issue kind of in parallel with Craig and keeping him up to date with some of the stuff I'm looking into. And one of the things I'm looking into is the physics of Lloyd England's story. In other words, if you have a plane coming in at 500 knots, hitting a light pole, and then flinging that light pole into Lloyd's cab, which was coming towards it at 40 miles an hour, what kind of kinetic energy are you going to have when that pole hits his car? I believe that there is no physical scenario possible where such an impact wouldn't just destroy his car, let alone damage the hood. I think it would just completely destroy his car and wreck it.
Yep.
And he'd be lucky to escape a lot after an impact like that. But, Craig, maybe you can tell me what you think of the physics of the story.
Well, I completely agree with you. I mean, if... You know, we're assuming what would happen if a pole actually was hit, and we're giving the benefit of the doubt. You know, Ted made the point earlier, and I agree completely with that the plane never would have made it to the building. It would have been those wings would have exploded because they were full of fuel. David Chandler actually in 2015 in his presentation in Oakland. Claimed that because there was fuel in the wings, that would have made them heavier and therefore more able to knock the poles down. So I gather that Ted wouldn't go along with that. So yes, I don't think there's any chance that those poles could have been hit. First of all, you know, because of the damage it would have done to the wings. But even if they could, just think of a plane going that speed, making contact with that pole and then knocking it towards a car that's traveling at 40 miles per hour in the opposite direction. The idea that it would go through the windshield, bend the front seat, not even tear it, but just bend it, and then magically stop, without going right through the car is just kind of absurd. So I would completely agree. The physics are ridiculous. And, you know, it's such an obvious falsehood in the official story. It's such an important opening for the truth movement, which is why it's so frustrating when people try to prop up Lloyd's story or paper over the things that he says that are just absurd. And there's many that I didn't even get to in this presentation. Many things he said that just completely don't add up at all. So, yeah, I think the physics of it absolutely make no sense at all, for sure. And I'm hoping that somebody else besides you, Adam, I mean, I'm glad for the questions I've had so far, but I was hoping to get some questions dealing with England and the England story himself. Anyway, I got one from Adam, so I'm glad for that, but I'm hoping there might be something more than that.
Anybody else with a question or comment for
James
Craig?
Hufford.
James, go ahead.
Yeah, this might be just facetious. I don't know, but could it be that could it be that Lloyd England was just trying to get a an insurance claim out of it and get a new cab?
Well, you know, that's interesting. But of course, how would he do that without? If he were really trying to do something like that, without it being planned in advance, then I would wonder how could he do that? How could he successfully, damage his cab without being seen? There are problems with the idea that he would have been able to do anything like this on his own.
Yeah, I agree. Hearing his interviews, I don't think he could have come up with it.
Well, the funny thing that people don't realize, I think a lot of people don't realize, and I learned something, even though Jeff Hill is somebody who I've, as a researcher who I really have no use for, he did an interview with Lloyd England, an audio interview in 2010, and in that interview, he basically, Lloyd comes right out and says he thinks 9/11 was an inside job, and he has doubts about whether the plane even hit the building. Which is pretty interesting. It's pretty interesting. But you really need to really get a sense of what he's saying. You really have to listen to all the interviews and kind of, because you can, he's not the most articulate person, so you can be misled, if you don't really go over all of it.
Yeah. My impression was that he had his perception of it, and then he was trying to integrate the perception, the scripting that he'd been fed, too, into that.
Well, yeah. I mean, he definitely, it's funny, you can hear him in different interviews repeat the same three or four kind of phrases, in multiple interviews. It's almost like he had a certain list of things he had to say. And he got those memorized, and I mean, that's speculation on my part, of course. He does have a story that is just, beyond unlikely, and it's also just awfully darn convenient for the official story. I think the story is obviously a complete fabrication.
Well, the fact that the hood paint wasn't even scratched does it for me.
Well.
I don't want to hear any more after that.
Well, absolutely. He describes the way he explains that. Interestingly enough, is he says that the pole came in at a downward angle, like the way he points. It looks to be about a 45-degree angle by the way he's motioning on the video. But of course, that's impossible in terms of the damage to the inside of the car.
Right.
That would have gone right through the floor of the car.
Sure, just crunch the car.
So, yeah. So it's he, and whenever there's something he's told something that's impossible, like something in his story that doesn't line up, he just repeats it, just sticks to it, and I was there, you weren't there. So.
Craig,
go ahead.
I have a question. This is Nalise.
Yep.
Hi, Nalise.
I had heard that his wife worked for the FBI.
Right. Well, that's an interesting one, too. Sorry, were you going to finish that? Did you want me to comment?
He's a very sympathetic character. I think he had a script. I think he was told what to say. And, the fact that there is no damage on the windshield right there just proves.
Right. Well, the thing about the FBI is that you raise is interesting because Lloyd told CIT in 2006 that she worked for the FBI, and he said this on more than one occasion. And when he was asked, well, what does she do there? He was very kind of mysterious, like, oh, we don't talk about it. We can't talk about it. And even she said to them, like, oh, I don't talk about that, implying that she's got some sort of a top secret job there. And then two years later, he's asked again about that, and he says, oh, no, she's a cleaner in the building. She's a cleaner.
Right.
And, you know, so that's a problem because the claim later, the claim that they make is that they asked her, they were looking for Lloyd. According to Lloyd, they couldn't find him, and they were looking for him because they thought he'd been killed in the car, which is crazy to start with because there's no body in the car. But so they were saying, well, where's Lloyd? So if she was a cleaner in the building and didn't actually work for the FBI, how would they know to ask her, where's your husband? You know, how would they make that connection? It just really sounds like a made-up story.
Okay. Any other questions for Craig? Okay. Well, Craig, I want to thank you for pursuing this and for challenging the Costi Chandler folks and challenging them when they take personal criticisms. And I know that's a hard thing to do, but you've done it, and I thank you for that because you're doing it for all of us. So.
Thanks, Cheryl. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you, Craig.
Okay, and so now we're ready for Lawrence Fine, who is going to talk to us a bit more about the World Trade Center and what happened there. And Lawrence, I thought that Susan was going to be on to introduce you. Are you there, Susan?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
Great.
Lawrence Fine, otherwise known as Lorenzo, he's been a mechanic for airlines, in the Air Force, and he understands how things are put together. He's designed exhibits for the Science Museum, and he comes, with this kind of working knowledge of how things work.
How do things work is what I want to know.
Yeah.
All right. We're giving a presentation on discovery of two distinct cavities that are located beneath where building number 4 stood. Has anyone looked at the website? Has anyone got that up?
Okay, so that one is also in the agenda, correct?
Yeah, it's in the text there for the agenda.
Yeah. Have to go in there to look at it. There's at the top of the page, there is a deep holes is one of the pages in the site. So please click on deep holes. And as you scroll down, there will be a number of images with text on them.
Wow.
The first image is the one that woke me up to
there was a big discrepancy in the in my opinion, is a huge discrepancy in the opinion of the geologist that wrote this report. This was claimed to have been caused by ice age erosion or plunge or whirlpools. But that would mean an awful lot of water would have to be moving very, very fast through this place. But there's no entrance and there's no exit. And if you look at the details and the coloration of this, it's all very, very, very clean at the bottom. And you notice that the rock fractured at the top. And you'll also notice, if you look to the side, there are these interesting concavities, undercut the, you know, the bedrock that sits above. Second image was taken during construction of the World Trade Center, and it shows the surface of the bedrock with the you know, the transit and the footprints for towers 1 and 2. Building number 4, where the cavity that we are looking at in the image above here, building number 4 is, if you see that blue line there, it's follow that blue line up right. Building number 4 is built just on the other side of the slurry wall that separated the west bathtub, which WTC 1 and 2 are in, and building number 6 from the east bathtub, which had building number 4 in it. Third image is of the west bathtub, you know, concentrating on the west bathtub, and the two circles are, the two red circles are making notes of areas of the bedrock that are disturbed. The one on the right, you notice that there's a backhoe, the orange machine right in the middle of the image, and there's a pumper, a blue pumper just to the left within the circle that's pumping water onto this. There's similar stuff going on with the arrow pointing closest to us. We'll get into more about that image later. You don't notice very much other than what appears to be a rubble pile at the bottom of the ramp or underneath the ramp where Building 4 was. We're looking to the the top center right of the picture is where Building number 4 stood. We have damage reports from beneath. They talked about, in this particular one, collapsed or heavily damaged beneath the World Trade Centers. That, if you look at the image of the pristine bedrock where they were building them, it looked nothing like that when they were building these towers. The bedrock has been disrupted, been moved badly. A damage report further down. Also, I invite you to look at this interactive Google Earth overlay, which was discovered maybe about a year ago, at some point. Please bookmark this so you can come back and study and ask me questions later. The next one down, below the interactive Google Earth overlay, is another damage report, and notice the note of a deep hole to the left of WC2, the South Tower, and also number one. The color code says gone, and this is beneath the towers. Look at WTC4, which nobody has paid any attention to WTC4. It says bad, but why would it be bad? The east wall of WTC2 fell on WTC4, but it damaged the top of it. It didn't damage the sub-basement.
Huh.
William Rodriguez's testimony in the morning and a number of other eyewitnesses say that there were explosions going off in the basement before the first plane struck. The next image down is a very well-defined image, and this is when you have an extremely energetic event that takes place beneath the level of the Earth, whether it be in sand or bedrock or anywhere. You have an extremely energetic event, you know, that's energetic enough to vaporize vaporize stone, then that material is going to go away as a gas. What is going to happen? I mean, the whole structure of this material gets reorganized when an awful lot of heat is applied to it. So those circles that I have, and you can notice that there's a fence. There's the closest, low center, very well defined disruption in the lower bedrock, and if you follow that fence, that's to guide the equipment that's coming down the ramp. Also, look at the bottom of the ramp. There are a number of what appear to be concrete planks placed on what should have been really solid bedrock. And why would they have had to do that if this was indeed solid bedrock? These two circles are highlighting what I claim to be subsidence craters, which you can find in Nevada test sites. Just Google subsidence, S-U-B-S-I-D-N-C-E, crater. What's below there is probably very similar to what we saw in that first picture that we looked at that is beneath building number 4. And that's just one of the indications. Now, this is where it gets really deep. The only other stuff that I know of that does that is nuclear, a reaction where you can get an awful lot of heat in a very, very short period of time. The heat is what does all this work. You notice that it didn't blow the living daylights out of that rocket. It heated it up an awful lot in a very short period of time. So this is what happens when you heat up an awful lot of, you have an awful lot of heat in a hole in the ground. Going down further, geological report. On the left, there's an image with black illustrations, pretty smooth contour line. On the right is corals and pinks. That is a post 9/11 geological survey. These are both of the same site. You can see that Liberty Street is a common street in both of them, and Church Street runs up to the right, although you can't see that designated in the pre 9/11 geological report. So this is engraved in stone. This is this is stuff that they recorded, but this is what stone that they measured to. They're not measuring to sandbox. They're measuring to stone. They're not measuring to a rubble pit. They're measuring to stone here. There's an overlay. The next one is just two images, and I invite you to grab these images if you want to play with them yourselves. But those show the location of both the pre and the post location for a comparison of what the site underneath the roof looked like before and after 9/11. And then there's an overlay so that there's a dead-on comparison. And then there's an animated GIF that toggles between them on the site plan. It shows the location of these 40-foot deep craters beneath building number 4. One underneath, pretty much the right center, facing down. That would be the southeast center, and then just slightly outside the east wall. Looking at those the topographics as bullseyes, you can say that something happened pretty much in the center of each of those odd-shaped bullseyes. And then looking up above, this is the dead giveaway. The cross-section that is shaded, two different shades. The lower shade is what they eventually excavated to. But when they did the survey, there were still two sections of lead that were sitting above the site that were included in the survey. I don't know whether they have been removed, but they're in the survey. There's a bulge just below the dark section, between the dark and the light section. And you can see there's an overhang, and then it cups. That bulge, or the belly, the waist, gives you a good indication of the depth that the event occurred at, and that's about 20 feet below the existing surface of the bedrock. The breadth of it is around 40 feet, and each one of these cavities is about identical in the amount of material that disappeared. So I venture to say that the yield of whatever devices these were was about equal, and that they may have very well gone off simultaneously. Most likely, mm-hmm. because anything that energetic would affect the other one. The last thing, I started a group called geologists and physiologists, excuse me, physicists for 9/11 studies. And one of the members of that group who saw this image, I had mentioned that it was in New York, said that is anatexy, and that is a really interesting new addition to my vocabulary. And what we are looking at here is one of the best comparisons that I could come up with as far as the textures and the surface shapes. Looking up above this wonderful, you know, bellied out, you know, this concavity in the side wall of this 40-foot deep cavity. This is in the sidewall of the cavity. Looking up above it, you see the way the colors go from the grays to the oxides, you know, the stuff that was in the rock that, you know, before, but you can see that it was still spalled or broken away, affected by the... And then above that, you see that the bedrock above it is fractured. This is not Ice Age erosion. This is the evidence of an extremely energetic event having occurred on the morning of 9/11, and there's an awful lot of evidence. William Rodriguez, you can see images in some of the videos that are available of gases venting from below the towers. Now, it's shooting up into the air. So there's so much evidence that supports these events were not as claimed by the interpretation of the geologists about this is totally off. So that's pretty much the presentation. And I'll answer any questions.
Okay, anybody have questions for Lorenzo? Or comments?
If no one's lined up, I'll ask one, Cheryl.
Okay, go ahead.
Lawrence, the suggestion, I guess, that you're making is, or you're talking about the possibility of a nuclear explosion in the bedrock. And what I'm wondering is, if they were doing that, why would they do it in that location as opposed to putting them under the two towers, which I gather would create an opening that would allow material from the buildings to go into? I don't know, but I'm just wondering why there instead of under the twin towers themselves.
Well, first of all, how long did it take to discover for me to rediscover these reports? I don't know. I have no idea why. There are a number of friends who have said that there were vaults beneath Building 4 in the sub-basement or possibly in the bedrock. Again, the indications are that whatever occurred here happened at around 20 feet below the surface of the bedrock that Building number 4 was built on, not in the sub-basement area itself, but drilled into or in a cavity, in a compartment, in an opening, in a place where a device could be installed. So this is an area that I'm not really interested in researching further. The interest that I had was understanding where these holes were, and finally getting the geological surveys was the completion of my study on it.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome.
Anyone else have a question for Lorenzo? Okay, Lorenzo, I just wanted to ask you, what companies or whatever were in Building 4?
I haven't studied any of that. Again, my only interest is in, you know, I focused on this image, and I said, what caused that? And you know, that's where,
okay.
And this is where I've gone with.
Okay, great, all right. Okay, anyone else?
So okay. That's for everybody else to figure out why this is there, who put it there, it wasn't there before, and it's a mighty big feature.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for all your research into that and for sharing it with us.
Welcome.
And
it's a pleasure to finally get it off my chest.
Okay. And so that brings us to the end of our conference where we were talking about any new events or anything anyone wants to share. I'd just like to say that there's a Red Pill Expo going to be in Hartford, Connecticut on June 7th through the 9th. And then Richard Gage will be speaking at that, and then after we're having him do a presentation on Sunday evening at the University of Hartford. So that's happening here in the Northeast. Anybody else have announcements? Or?
This is David. I have a question. I don't know if this was covered at the beginning, but is anybody working on anything for the Left Forum, either at the Left Forum or a counter event?
I know that I don't think you are, Kat, right, this year? Kat's still on? Oh, she's not there. We're not doing anything with it. We've kind of given up on them the way they've...
I'm here. I'm sorry.
But you are, Kat.
Yeah, I've kind of given up, too.
Yeah. So just curious,
okay, well,
why is
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I just wanted to check on that. Somebody asked me to find out. So.
Okay. I'm sorry, someone had a question?
Yes, hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, yes, is there any reason that you've given up? Just curious.
Kat, do you want to respond to that?
One is personal. I've had, like, a tumultuous past 6 months. My whole life is, like, upended in different ways. So that probably is more primary, but also... It really takes the toll, and there's no way that they were going to let us do anything, so you have to subvert. And on the one hand, they kind of won. You know, you can only keep trying to fight against them so much, and it was just too much. So that coupled with my own personal life, it's like, I don't think I'm going to try it this year.
Well, one thing that we should do perhaps is have our own Left Forum and invite groups that are not welcomed into the Left Forum.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like a great idea.
Because, like, I'm also involved with this feminist group, and we asked to have a panel. And, of course, you know, you can't have any feminist panel unless it's so the title is so obscure that no one will go to it.
Really, at the Left Forum? I'm surprised.
Oh, yes, because they're so pro trans.
Hmm.
Oh, so anytime you want to talk about safe sex bathrooms, safe single sex bathrooms, or you know, men invading women's sports, that's a no-no. Even the birth control abortion question was no-no.
Yeah. Well. I don't know if you know the history that Kat and I put on some panels there for, I think, 3 years in a row we did it, and, you know, they canceled us last minute on the last 2 years, and so then we took it online last year instead. So and they canceled on us, I think, like, what was it, like 5 days before the event and that kind of thing. So that's another reason we've given up on them. But, yeah. So if anyone has the energy to do a Left Forum that would include all of those issues, then go for it.
No, I mean, they're not going to let us. I mean, if they gave such a difficult time, and not just to me, I know some other people and other groups, and they were just completely shut out. Like, whereas in the past, it was like, okay, we'll keep you a panel at like Saturday at the first panel.
Mm-hmm.
They were like, no way.
Right, so what I'm saying is you had suggested that we do our own. And
yeah,
like,
yeah, maybe with other groups we could do something together.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I'd be willing to do that. I'm just not sure. I mean, do you think, my question is, do you think it's possible to schedule something maybe later, like something that we can give out at the Left Forum?
If you're asking, I think if you want, first I think you have to have a group that's going to plan that with you.
Oh,
right.
I mean, I can get like numerous different groups. Who can have a panel here, a panel that? The question would be, when could we host something, and should we give out literature at the Left Forum? About, let's say, a Left Out Forum.
Why not call it the Progressive Forum?
No.
Well, if you know, in just my opinion, I think you have to get a group together and plan what you're going to do, pick dates, where you're going to hold it, and then if you have that all done before the Left Forum, when the Left Forum, you know, takes place, then sure, pass out literature there.
Wasn't Kevin Barrett booted from them also?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, we are.
I don't know. Is there anyone here that would maybe, I don't know who's on this phone call, but is there anyone that might like to do something? I mean, I you know.
Well,
I'm
live
pretty sure
them.
Kevin Barrett would.
Okay, can Kevin Barrett or anyone else give me a call?
Well, I live in the middle part of the country, and part of the problem is that all of these big events are always on the East Coast or the West Coast, and I don't have any money to get to any of them to present or to attend.
Could always do something by Skype.
I know
it's not the same. I know.
Maybe have my own and invite everybody from both coasts in.
That's a good idea.
Good idea.
Yeah.
So, any other thoughts or comments before we pause for the evening?
Actually, I have a quick one, Cheryl.
Yeah,
I just wanted to mention I'm working on an article for architects and engineers right now that might be of interest to people. It should be out within a few days, I think. But it's about this project due diligence. I don't know how many people have followed this, but it's presentations by volunteers who are engineers within A&E that are presentations to other professional engineering groups or chapters of national associations. And this one that the reason I'm writing about this is that one of the people in Wisconsin was approached, and so the volunteers were given a chance to make a presentation to a joint meeting of the American Society of Civil Engineers and the National Society of Professional Engineers. And so they did that, and then the person who could have introduced them at that meeting invited them to speak to the statewide annual conference of the Wisconsin Society of Professional Engineers. So,
wow.
And it sounds like the response that they got was extremely positive. And I can tell you, I interviewed the guy from the Engineering Association, and he was super positive about it and very, you know, happy to have invited them. And it sounded like that's a whole untapped area that AE is really looking at now and talking to. The engineers seem to be really much more open and positive towards the evidence. Yeah. So, thought that was a bit of good news.
Great, yeah.
That's great news.
Yeah.
With Richard being an architect, I was involved early. Someone mentioned earlier about Marty Hooper being on the call, and that there was this documentary that they were showing, and I just wanted to mention that it's The Demolition of Truth. Psychologists, I forgot the last part of it. Anyway, I made it, and I also was the executive producer with Richard Gage of The Demolition of 9/11 Explosive Evidence, Experts Speak Out. So, but I wanted to thank her for mentioning that film and let you guys know that The Demolition, if you just type in Demolition of Truth, you'll find it on my YouTube channel. I've posted the complete full cut for free. And it's got fantastic psychologists and psychiatrists like Marty Hooper and Fran Schur And David Ray Griffin is in there for on the theological level, and it's got a lot of great stuff. So I recommend everybody go just type in Demolition of Truth, and you'll find it on my channel. Charles Ewing Smith is my channel, so that would be where you'd want to see it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thanks for sharing that, Charles.
Great.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anybody else?
This is Adam.
Go ahead, Adam.
Hi. Well, I don't know if this is the right time to request it, but I was thinking about making a short presentation maybe on the next call about the Pentagon and about the demeanor of our opposition on this subject. Because I think the demeanor of our opponents is very telling, and demeanor is something that that we don't really look into. And what I'm driving at is that the question of motives, which was brought up tonight, why would these people be resisting and trying to tell a false story of events at the Pentagon? And the subject of motive is sort of shunned, but demeanor of an individual is something detectives talk about a lot, is the demeanor of the people that they're dealing with. And I think I can shed a little light on what their possible motives are and talk about their demeanor somewhat.
Okay. So, Adam, our June call is really full at this point. Would you be willing to do July?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Great. Okay. That'd be great. All right.
I would just be talking about something very short, maybe 10 minutes at most.
10 minutes? Okay. Okay, great. So, yeah, so if you plan on the July call, and I'll don't know the date off the top of my head right now, but we can look it up. But, okay, great. Thanks for offering to do that. And anyone else before we adjourn? Any other thoughts or comments? Or? Okay, great. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us tonight, and we'll see you next month.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night.
Thanks for hosting again.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.